The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Life of Flow podcast. Today, we had a great conversation with Amy J. Goldberg. She is the Dean, Chair, and Professor of Surgery at the Lewis Katz School of Medicine at Temple University Hospital. She's also the Vice Chair of the American Board of Surgery, and she was my program director and somebody that was very influential in how I kind of developed and what I thought a surgeon should be and a leader should be, and a person I greatly admire. So, yeah, we dove into it. We talked about leadership. We talked about training, and we went into, good like, stuff. AI.
I thought it was very interesting. Yes. Yeah. Many, many tangents, but all very interesting. Hope you enjoyed as much as we did.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Are you avoiding showing your legs because of varicose veins? Worry no more. At Hope Vascular and Podiatry, we have the solution. Our vascular specialists are ready to rid you of those pesky varicose veins. Regain your confidence and enjoy life without complexes. Call 346-400-4673 or visit our website at www.hcic.io. Because at Hope Vascular and Podiatry, the new normal is you better.
All right. Amy, Dr. Goldberg, how are you? Thank you for coming on the Life of Flow podcast and taking some time out of your weekend to join us. This little project serves as our own little like therapy, and where we kind of like have our own little like pet projects or themes. And, you know, when we started this, I knew that I kind of wanted to have you on and reminisce a little bit about, you know, Philly, and also talk about leadership, just because, you know, now being on the other side of things, you think about leadership, you think about how to be a good leader and develop yourself as a leader, which, you know, it's something that nobody really teaches you kind of until you're on, in the path. But we can talk about anything. So welcome to the podcast.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you, Lucas. Thank you, Miguel. It's really fabulous, and I'm really honored to be on the podcast with you both, and really looking forward to exploring whatever it is that you want to explore. I have great memories of you, Lucas. I'll start there, if you don't mind. I know you're not really asking a question, but you got me. I was pretty hard on you when I look back. And you,
yeah, and that's part of it. I mean, I think that, you know, as you know, I don't know. I don't think that much time has passed, you know, from where I was in residency to now. But I think that when I look and interact with residents now, and you know, that model, which I thought I experienced, is not a valid model anymore. At least it's not here in Austin, Texas. It may be in other parts of the country. I think, you know, residents are way more, I guess the word would be like empowered in a way, and the interactions are different. I remember very fondly residency, even though it was very hard. And I think part of it was the group of people. I feel lucky with my co-residents, and they were a huge support group. And I think that the residents I interact with here have a very similar culture where they're very supportive. But the way I interact with residents is not the way that the way I experience it. And I wonder, first of all, you know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And I think it's just a thing. It's just an evolution of culture. You know, sometimes I think back of, you know, James Campbell, you know, the hero with 1,000 faces. We all have to conquer our dragons. We all have to conquer our mountains. And what does that mountain look like? And does it need to look like the same for everyone? But anyways, have you experienced that shift in culture in residency, or like with other attendings or with staff? Or how has it been from when you started, which was even more extreme than when I was there,
yep.
right? To now where you are, you know, the dean of the medical school. So you have to interact with people in all parts of the ladder. And I know you're probably still taking call, although I don't know if that's true or not, but I imagine you are just knowing that that's kind of crazy. So you have to interact with the medical students, with the residents, with the staff, all the way to the C-suite.
Yeah.
So that's a big question, but I don't know.
Well, I think in leadership, the one thing you need to appreciate is that everything changes and things will not be the same. So I do look at the past 30 years of surgical training or even medical training, the changes that have occurred have been good. And, you know, people always talk about, well, those good old days. Well, sometimes those good old days weren't really so very good. You know, we look back on them with fondness because we wonder why we would have done it if it were so bad. But for me in my training, the hours were very long, too long. There wasn't a lot of oversight, supervision, and not really a lot of support. And you may look at your training as exactly the same thing. I hope not, but you could when you reflect back. But I think the changes that have occurred with surgical residency training, whether it's duty hours or simulation, or just a focus on wellness, I think all of that is really good, even though it was very different for me and probably different for you, even though I did try to make for you, try to make it a little better than it was for me, but still make sure that you understood the importance of working hard, training hard, and accountability to the patients and your fellow residents. I don't think that will ever change. That doesn't change in medicine. Accountability to the patients and your fellow residents or colleagues.
Now, Amy, your career or your life in Temple goes back to even residency. And could you foresee yourself being in a situation of leadership at this point back in the days, or was that something more of an evolution that slowly started kind of coming apparent that was a way for you?
I never saw any of this coming, none. You know, I matched at the into Temple's residency program out of medical school, and even though it was exceedingly hard for those 5 years, I felt a real community. And I felt a real purpose to the mission that Temple had. I decided I wanted to do trauma. And after a year down at Shock Trauma in Baltimore, Maryland, you know, I came back to Temple to be a trauma surgeon. And it just so happens that was 30 years, you know, August 2023 marked 30 years that I was a trauma surgeon at Temple. I guess I can't lie my age that much. But I really wanted to be a trauma surgeon at Temple, and that was really it. I was so fortunate that these other opportunities presented themselves and that that I was selected to, whether that's being the residency director or the chief of trauma or the chair of the Department of Surgery or now even the dean. I never saw any of that coming. I just followed my heart and my passion, which was Temple. Temple surgery, Temple trauma, Temple education, Temple research, and just fortunate that I am where I am and that Temple's been very good for me, as I hope I've been very good for Temple.
And looking back now, you know, seems like it wasn't a plan to ascend the ladder that way, but looking back now, are there things that you did, or maybe things that you didn't, that you would, you know, recommend in a very tactical way to people that are early in career, mid-career, even later in their career, to both kind of like set you up to learn the skills to be a leader or that to help someone along that way, since, you know, the amount of training and what it's the definition of a good leader can be very subjective.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I think I'm a really bad example because I wasn't very directed in this is what I want from my next stage of my career. I joke around and tell people that I was the queen of the interim because I was the interim everything before I assumed the position. So in some regard, when I'm speaking to students and residents or faculty, I do give the disclaimer in that I was not very methodical in going after something. But I do think part of being a good leader is twofold. I think it is recognizing, you know, what you like out of something and following your heart in that. And I think at any level, whether you have a official title or not, you can certainly lead. So I would like to think that as a resident, I saw things that I wanted to change if I ever got in a position to change it. Same thing with being a young attending or even as chief of trauma. And I think that we are called upon to leadership moments where we may not really even be in those positions. I don't know if that makes sense. You know, I do remember my father saying to me during residency when it was very hard, he said, you know, Amy, you have to play the game to stay in the game to change the game. You know, play the game to stay in the game to change the game. And I really would like to think that I've done just that. You know, and I think part of being a good leader is, you know, self-reflection, really. You know, what emotional intelligence, you know, do you have? And, you know, where, you know, really striving for your own personal growth. And I think out of personal growth, people can ascend to leadership roles.
You consider yourself an extrovert?
No. God,
what, no. Intro?
I'm an introvert, and these extroverted things just exhaust me to no end.
Yeah,
I was about to say, because I feel that one of the biggest challenges that I would foresee having, and we have it now, because obviously Luke has dragged me into this thing. But when we have these, we do, we do 6, 7, 8 of these things. And at the end of the day, I want to hide in a very quiet place and not talk to human beings for like 5 weeks. Right. I feel, they're intellectually challenging, but also emotionally challenging and charged, and you're putting yourself out there. And this is, for me, this one moment every other month that we do this. But I feel that somebody in a position of leadership is under the constant eye of everybody. And you have to just play this exhaustive role of excellence. Like, it just feels like you can't screw up. There's so much weight socially, ethically, morally, professionally. I applaud you for doing that, but how difficult is it for a self-proclaimed introvert to have to act like an extrovert on a daily basis, nonstop? What does that mean to you, Amy? I don't know you, but just with the little bit that I had from you, I feel that I hear that introvert already, and I'm thinking, wow. Like, that's kind of like, because I'm the same way in many ways, is I feel that could be tough. So walk me through how you manage that on a daily, weekly, yearly basis.
Well, you're very laser-like, and this is perfect timing because you're so right. I mean, this week I was like, well, why? I'm so exhausted. Like, it comes to noon, and I'm like so tired already. And it is because it is that constant of being on. That's why you have to really follow your heart. If I didn't love Temple in the way that I loved Temple, and I didn't love the students and our faculty and our researchers and the mission, it would be impossible. I mean, first I would do a terrible job, but it would be impossible. I couldn't even do it because I just wouldn't be able, I just wouldn't be able to do it. But it lately has been even more exhausting than previously. And I have a chief of staff, believe it or not. And I was talking to my chief of staff and I was like, my God, why am I so tired? You know, and it's because, you know, we're really trying to drive the agenda of the school, and every meeting is a high stakes meeting where either people want something for me or I want something from them. And it is this beautiful dance for both of us to get what we want. But you know, we're doing it for the school. And I will also tell you, like when I walk in a room now, it's not Amy Goldberg anymore that walks in the room, which makes me so sad. It's the dean. It's the dean that walks in the room. You know, nobody sees Amy anymore. Everybody just sees the dean, and that's really tough for me because I just see Amy. But you know, I think mental strength and physical strength is really important to overcome some of that, right? So you have to love what you do. And you have to have some strong mental skills. And then you have to, like, I came home last night and I have like a rowing machine here. And I like got on my rowing machine for like mental health last night, you know? So I'm sorry, go ahead, Lucas.
No, yeah, I wanted for you to expand on that because we've talked a lot about, you know, mental health and kind of dealing with, obviously not that kind of stress, but we all carry, you know, our fair amount. You know, what do you do to stay sane? Like, you know, do you have a routine every morning? Do you ever after routine? How many vacations? Do you go vacation often? Not at all? Like, are you happy with how you're managing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing about mental health is recognizing that sometimes you're not in a good space. So I think you have to recognize that, like, oh, I'm really tired, or oh, you know, I'm dragging, I'm a little down or whatever. So I think you have to recognize that you can be vulnerable to that and that you need to, you know, I don't want to use the word protect because sometimes protect means like deny. It's not deny. You have to bring it on in and kind of figure out, okay, well, what does make you feel good? You know, so, you know, sometimes the introvert in me doesn't want to do anything on a weekend. But since this is just talking with two friends, I didn't think that this would be so terrible, and it's certainly not, yeah. You know, but it's not kind of recharging over the weekend. You know, I love sports, so I'll either play or watch, you know, I'll run, I'll golf in good weather. But it's really trying not to have a schedule, not having to be someplace at some time, really going out with friends, people that you're really close with, so you don't have to be on your guard, I guess, as one might be at a work event or something like that. But I think you have to recognize that you need to refuel, and that's really critical.
I think that the older I get, the lesser friends I have.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, you just start kind of cleaning your bandwidth.
Yeah.
There's that one friend that you kind of have to act a little bit different with because, you know, it just makes things better. I'm at the point where that's not worth it.
Yeah.
If I have to just even slightly modify some of the things that I need to do to coexist, even though they may be phenomenal, you know, my adult human bandwidth is so limited that I don't care for it. Right. It's just, and I could see that probably being even more so if I had to then be always bright, right? And always, you know, being dean-like to come to the weekends and then having to be dean-like on the weekends. It doesn't make too much sense, right? It just seems like there's a lot that goes on there. Getting into this, and a little bit away from personality and more about the hardships of getting there, right? I'm sure it wasn't a clear path to get to where you were, and it wasn't an easy path. Do you feel that at times there was failure in your capacity as a leader?
I mean, I know that you know, you've been chief of trauma and critical care, residency, you know, all these kind of steps that got to this kind of pinnacle in many ways. Was there a lot of moments where you look back and you say, I could have probably done that much better? And how do you reflect upon those days? And what does that mean for
who you are now? Yeah, I mean, there is no success without failure. There truly is no success without failure. It's like when you're a resident and you're doing the case with the attending and you actually think you're doing the case. You know, and you think you're like really a good surgeon, you know, until you start taking somebody through a case where you learn the most when you struggle. You never learned as a resident. I never learned when things went well because I thought things went well because of, like, who knows what I was doing. But sometimes it had nothing to do with what I was doing. So for sure, there is only success with failure. And I embrace that now much more. It's hard to embrace it when you're younger, you're going through it, and you have all of these doubts about yourself. So you see a failure like you're never going to get back up off the mat. But when you've been on the mat and you've gotten back up and you've done that like a few times, and then you know that that failure is part of success. And in fact, you want to share that because you don't want other people to have the failures that you've had. They're going to have their own. They don't need to have yours. So you know, in teaching and educating, you're hoping that somebody can learn from you. You know, I don't think I was saying this at M&M, Lucas, when you were a resident, but I would always say, you know, the good thing about tomorrow is hoping that I'm better tomorrow than I am today. You know, and that's what M&M is all about, you know, is being better the next day and the next case. Where when you're young and you just don't believe in yourself, it's very hard. It's very hard to learn from your failures. But yes, I have had many, and many of them are, I think kind of how I interact with people. You know, I'm a pretty feisty person. Lucas can maybe tell you off podcast or whatever. But I'm a pretty feisty. And feistiness is good, and probably being feisty has got me to where I am, but you have to temper that a little bit, I think, as you ascend through the ranks. It's not always embraced well. And I remember about 20 years ago, one of my mentors said to me, as I was beginning to ascend on the journey of leadership, he said to me, Amy, sometimes when you talk, I cringe.
That's a pretty direct comment. Yeah, I like
how do you, because I find myself being, I guess let's call it, passionate at some points when I think something should be done one way, or I feel like really there's a moment of, you know, when the ship needs to take another turn, needs to take a turn to not hit something. And I've had, some feedback that, you know, maybe I shouldn't be as passionate, or I shouldn't be as strong. I don't know how you say that.
Strong-willed?
Not willed, but just the way I say it should be with a little more tact. And, you know, my intention is never to put another human down, or to make that other person feel less than. My intention is always to try to motivate to perform at a higher level. And I can see how I don't do that well. But, you know, I imagine that, you know, having previous interactions, you probably faced something similar before, because I was on the other end of that sometimes. How have you like learned or changed over the years to have that effect of elevating performance and minimizing the making that individual feel like less? Because that's never the intention, making the individual feel like less. It's always you can do more, you can do better. And I find that balance very difficult.
So I think relationships with trainees, we can talk about me and you, or you and your trainees, should be unconditional. And I would hope, but you should tell me, I'll be sad, potentially, but I would hope that you knew when maybe you were the recipient of me being direct, for want of a better word, that I was unconditional, and I don't use this word lightly, in my love of you. Now, that could be just I'm making up an excuse for why I behaved a certain way. I don't think so. I do think I really loved you, and I think you knew that, or you would have never sent me that card and the Don Quixote that you sent me, right? Never. That was the nicest present I've ever gotten. So, I mean, I looked at that and I was like, oh my God, I think he got me, but I hope I didn't hurt you. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to hurt you, and I would have hoped, you know, and that's the trainee thing. I mean, that I loved you and cared about you, and it was always about the patient. Again, if these are just excuses, then that's not good. You know, I don't want to be making excuses to excuse a behavior of toughness. I hope not.
No, it never was, and it always felt like it was to elevate. I mean, I felt like during residency, I transformed from one person to another person. I was a different person when I left than the person, and I was a stronger person. You know, there was
still a lot more work that had to happen after. Just saying.
I know.
A lot more polishing.
That still needs to be done. No, for sure. For sure, 100%. But when I started, yeah, it was like even more. So I always felt that, and that's kind of like when I see somebody that's struggling, it's kind of the same way, that I just want them to be equipped for when things get tough, because right now they're not tough, but man, when you're out there on your own, they can get tough. So. And I think that, you know, going back to failure, learning how to fail is a skill. It's a skill that you need to learn. And you need to learn it by failing in a safe environment and being told, hey, you're failing. Do something different. But that can be tough. I think that getting that point across can be tough. And it can be, again, taken not from the act of love, of like, hey, I see where you're going. If you keep doing this, you're going to face these things because I've done them, you know, and instead of being like, okay, let me.
Well, I think you just had a great point though, right? So I'm sorry, but it's, you know, because you said you've done them. Sometimes people are just hard asses and they don't share their humility, their vulnerability, the mistakes that they made. So then you're just kind of coming down hard on somebody. Like, why'd you do this? It has to be like, man, I used to do this too, and this wasn't good, and I want you to learn from me. I mean, I think you have to share and expose yourself a little bit too, which I hope that I did. And I think when you see that a resident may not be performing at the level that you may want them to, or anybody, you have to lead with the question of, are you okay? How are you, and are you okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that I've come to realize about somewhat of the unfair nature of judgment by which we, in these highly complex scenarios like hospitals, there's so many people involved in judging our performance that sometimes we get, I would say, scolded, or that we get reprimanded for something that we do at a personality level, but that is essentially the essence of what has gotten us to where we are. Let me explain a little bit more. So if you say, listen, I'm passionate and I'm outspoken and I, you know, I'm very firm when I have to say something, And that got you in trouble with a student that felt that you were being derogatory. And it got you into a whole lot of trouble with the college. And then there's this committee that has to judge. And then somebody passes the judgment. And then you have to do some sort of, I don't know, remediatory course or whatever the heck they make you do to jump through hoops and loops. And so then there's this level of shame that comes with that. But here's what's I think interesting for us. And I'm not saying that with that, everybody that screws up, I mean, everybody screws up. I'm not saying that every time you screw up, there's a reason. But what I do think that should be important for you out there as you're progressing through your career, as you're facing some of these problems, as you're becoming a better leader, is you will face at times moments where there's questionable areas of your own personality that have somehow led you to be in trouble, but are the same things that have led you to be amazing. And I think that you have to be your own judge in that sense and understand, to your point, Amy, maybe you have given tough love and maybe at some points you've been, you know, a little bit rougher than you should have been. You certainly gave him PTSD, but it's the reason why you are where you are. And so you shouldn't be ashamed of this one driving phenomenal force that puts you on the map. Because yes, sometimes potentially somebody got a little hurt in the process, but all sitting down and looking at your career, 30 years of success, you've been put in the right place and you have touched many people and you keep doing it to people like Lucas or others. So there's this kind of weird balance where you have to keep your own accountability in this kind of longitudinal thing. Not sure. Have you ever looked at things in that way where you look back and you're like, okay, you know, all said and done, this has been really good to me and maybe it's been a little bit bad here, but it's probably a good thing for me and for other people overall.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think there's at times, I think there's a lot of rationalization that we do. Like for me, well, it's about the patient. You know, it's all about the patient. So of course it wasn't like, you know, it was about somebody washing a car or something like that. It's about the patient. You know, it's about the patient. And so I think, you know, I think that can be some rationalization. Or when I look back, it is like I was hardly as bad as the people that they were to me. But I really do think, and not that I would have changed it. Sorry, Lucas. I don't think I would have changed too much. Because it is about the patient, and I did care about you and do care about you. But I think, I don't know. You know, I would hope that people see that I am indiscriminate. And whether that's good, bad, that could be terrible. Like, I just don't use that. I don't use that behavior for just this. I'm across the board in those areas that are really critical, which is patient care. You know, I mean, there is no compromise in patient care. There is, we can make mistakes, we can learn from each other. We are, you know, there is no profession where you are perfect. You will never be perfect in medicine, ever. But you have to recognize when you've made a mistake, and if you're not the one to fix it, you better get on the horn and call somebody else, because those things, that could be unforgivable, whether it's your ego or your cognition that doesn't allow you to recognize that you've made a mistake. Like, I think it's okay to be vulnerable now as a surgeon. 30 years ago, you couldn't be, and I don't know how many patients were hurt by that, but now we're encouraged to call for help. We're encouraged to not do these things alone. We're encouraged about the team. And that's good.
And then so how do you drive, because, and how did you balance that? The way that things were, the way that you are, but also I think you had a great ability to get people on board with the mission. Because it felt like that. It felt like, okay, we're here. We just demand excellence at all times. And, you know, Temple, if nobody's ever been to North Philadelphia. Temple's a hard, you know, it's not, you know, the prettiest place in the world. But there was, you know, and you could see how a culture could not flourish in a space like that. But it was completely the opposite. It was a culture of excellence at all times. And you know, sometimes I find myself now doing small, you know, I'm trying to create a limb salvage clinic and trying to get allies. Wound care nurse here, administrator here, nurse practitioner here. How do you get them to be on board with the purpose, with the mission, with the excellence? How do you motivate these people to have the same passion that you have, which they might not, but how do you drive them with that passion?
I guess I look at that as an education. You know, it's educating, you know, it's first educating people about the mission or the importance or the priorities of students or patients. And then, you know, like everybody does want greatness. Most people do. People don't get up in the morning and go to work, no matter what they do, and say, I want to suck today. And I want people to yell at me and maybe I'll get fired today. I mean, no, people don't want that. They don't wake up that way. So I do think people want greatness and they want to strive for greatness and they want to be a part of something that's bigger than themselves. So that's what you have to create and show them that and help them get there. So I don't know if you can see, but I have some bracelets now for the school, right? So I have one bracelet that's big and bold. It says big and bold because I want people in the school to be thinking big and bold. But then I also have some four words that I've come now after, you know, 30 years or 20 years or whatever years in leadership that are really critical. Teamwork, optimism, communication, excellence. Like these are the things that matter. And that's how you build greatness. So I think it's bracelets like this that I may give out to my leadership team or words that I have stenciled on my conference room wall or just believing in people and believing that they want to be great and a part of something great. So it's educating them and then giving them that vision of what they can become a part of.
You say the best leaders are those who understand what the definition of success is for themselves, but more importantly for everybody in their team. And to be able to then become a catalyst for that success, to be able to give you the building blocks and to create the space for you, Lucas, to then become the best Lucas you can. That is a science, but also almost like an art. What do you feel, A, would you agree with that? And B, how do you go about trying to dive into everybody's inner psyche and try to gather what the definition of success for each one of those people is and try to provide those roads?
So I think it is, I do agree, but I actually think it's a lot more of an art, I think. Then, you know, leadership and motivation is really much more of an art. And I guess, to be honest, and I'll confess this, I mean, I'm not so sure that I really looked at what each person individually wants. I'm not so sure I've done that. And I have to think about that, because maybe that's an area that I need more growth in, where I just naturally assume what they want is the unit to excel. And I will say, I do get, I, you know, ooh, this does say a little something about myself, because sometimes I do get even more prickly when I may feel that the person wants themselves to excel over the unit. Then I get a little even more prickly, right. Because for me, it's like, I'm almost so naive and idealistic. Like, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean it's more about you than the unit of Temple? How, like, I'm like so offended by it. I take it so personally. Like, you know, for kind of being so old at times, I'm like so ridiculously idealistic still. But But I do think, because I do think people want to be a part of a team. I really do think they do. I think that keeps them.
Well, I think that's your style, yeah. Right? I mean, your style is, again, I don't know you personally, but it seems by what you're telling me is that your style is this kind of unity of we're doing this for this bigger picture that is more important than all of us at the individual level. But I do think also being, you know, having academic leadership roles in the past, that it's very important for me to understand the minutiae of the separate items so that the cohesiveness comes together in the best way possible. And, you know, some guys in your team are going to want to publish a billion papers a year. Some guys in your team just want to go home because they have a newborn. You know, some gals in the team don't care about anything. They want to make $2 million a year, however that is, and they want to be in the OR 14 hours a day, right? It's all those little yep. things that come together and understanding how do you shape that team and even saying, what's my missing link right now? So that all of a sudden, boom, this bigger thing that I have in my mind of the temple unit, you know, becomes a reality. And it's cool. I think that's yeah. cool of what you're in is you've got the capacity to try to keep the eye on the bigger picture. And I think that is an art, to your point.
Yeah, I mean, you need a first baseman, a second baseman, a third baseman, a shortstop. You know, you can't have everybody that's the utility player, you know. And not, you know, to a certain extent, people will excel at other things. So it's not, I don't necessarily expect every single person to be a researcher. They're not going to want to do that. If they don't like it, they're not going to want to do it. You know, they should be familiar with research. You know, so in the school, we have two tracks, an education track and more of a research track for the clinicians. You know, for the longest time, there was just a research track. So if you didn't publish, you weren't going to get promoted. And luckily we went to two tracks, as I'm sure other schools have also, so that you can be more individualized in what people are interested in.
Using your sports background here, we had Dr. Frank Beeth, who's for us this kind of godfather.
Yes, I know.
Okay, you know Frank. Okay, so he was saying how surgeons, there are sluggers, like there are these star elites in a team, right? The Shaqs, the Kobes, and that they have this masterful uniqueness that makes them just amazing at their art. But a lot of them have, you know, some locker room problems, right? You know, or bring some other things. And he was of the thought, and of course, Frank's a very senior element, and so he's very kind of old school, and he doesn't understand structure and, you know, a lot of the political correctness of the system, and he believes that we've become too correct. We've auto-corrected so much that we alienate some of the biggest stars that you could have in the team because we're trying to make everybody so PC and so perfect to fit into this algorithm. So my question to you, how do you view this in the more contemporary medicine? Is there still some latitude for some of your star phenomenal surgeons to not necessarily be perfect in any other sense? Or do you give away of the slugger and you try to make your team maybe average, but everybody more cohesive? What's your thought?
Zero tolerance for behavior that is not... not that this is the perfect word, professional, like zero tolerance for bad behavior, no matter who they are, no matter.
So no throwing pickups or saying bad words in the OR, getting stressed and starting to yell.
No matter who they are, because everybody looks and sees if you've tolerated that behavior. And if you tolerate that behavior, ultimately it brings everybody down, no matter how good one individual is. So it's easy to say you don't need to be PC if you haven't had to be the recipient of un-PC your whole career? I'm saying that as carefully as I can.
You don't need to be careful. We can say whatever.
Right? I mean, it's easy to say like, hey, let us all be PC when you never had a problem because everybody was, you were out there,
Yeah.
One, funny story, but one of the biggest guys in vascular surgery, chief of, I remember it because I came as an international exchange student when I was still a medical student, and I went to Harvard for a rotation. And this guy he just yelled so badly at me because I don't know if I stepped in the wrong spot in the OR, but I just remember being absolutely annihilated by this guy. And he would just be very, very negative. But he was the star, right? He was this biggest guy on the team, and he was the chief of this and the chief of that. And many years later, I heard he had to leave the hospital because of a second-year medical student after a rotation where he saw all this demeaning and derogatory behavior, wrote a letter to authorities, but not of the hospital, but like to the state, right? And it became such a big deal that this guy had to leave. And I do believe that. I don't see why there should be.
There can't be. The culture has changed. It's not that there should be or that it's okay or not. It's that there can't be. Like, we are in a different place as a society, as a culture. We're just talking with some friends. We're discussing this book. It's like something about the evolution of societies and of consciousness. And we probably have gone through the same way we evolve in our physical form. Probably our consciousness evolves as, we go from like hunter-gatherers to now dealing with like AI sentient, beings in your phone. Our way of viewing and interpreting the world is going to change. So, and I think right now, if you look culturally, I think we are going through a transition phase, and you can see it in divisions of people and how they view everything in the world. So, but I think that even though like we romanticize, or it can be romanticized, that approach, it's over. It's over. It's not coming back.
Which is good.
It is. Yeah, it is. Yeah, because evolution is good. Yeah, but this is evolution.
Match week. So match day is Friday, You may know, you may not know, but match day for the medical schools across this country is Friday. And 20 years ago, I think in 2004, 20 years ago, there were about 60 open categorical general surgery spots. Because no students wanted to be surgeons because of how the surgeons acted. So for many reasons, behaviors can't be tolerated. One, it's not appropriate. But two, if we continue to act like all of that, our students whose eyes are more wide open, they don't want to be us. And 20 years ago, they did not want to be surgeons because surgeons were working too hard, complaining too much, et cetera, et cetera. And they were like, we don't want this. And they showed that with their feet. So for 2 years in a row, double digit, like really like 50 or 60 open categorical spots. So for so many reasons, we can't continue to act like jackasses.
Yeah. And how do you see us do you see a continued evolution? Is there going to be another transition, like the one that you experienced into what it is now? Do you think it'll be like a continuum, or do you think that there is something, how do you view surgeons in 10 years? Like how are people going to describe us as a group in 10, 20 years?
I think some of the training paradigms will probably change a little bit. They'll be, as vascular surgeons, it will probably be doing vascular training right out of medical school for the the years that it takes. I think there needs to be some recognition of that. There will probably be, you know, I think the hardest thing of being a physician is no start or stop time in a day. I think that can be really challenging. So, you know, whether everybody becomes medical school, hospital employees, so, and people cross cover each other much more, and it's okay to go home and, hey, my patient needs to go back, but can you take the patient back for me? I have something with my kid at school. You know, I think we have to make sure that we are receptive. If we can be receptive to what the generations want and appropriately want, then there may not be much change, or there may not be people that are saying, I don't want to be like you. But if we are not open and receptive,
don't you think that idea of like the ACS type of call? So we had this conversation on our last recording session with Vinita Chandra. She's a great vascular surgeon out of Stanford, and we had this same conversation. We were talking about the difficulty of call and such. I don't know how I feel about that, about shift work as a vascular surgeon. Sometimes it does have, I know it has a lot of positives. It's like, yeah, but you know, I don't have kids, so obviously I don't have the responsibility, but I could see if I had kids, how that would be a big thing. The other part of me says, no, that's my patient. That's my complication. That's, you know, I'm going to see this through, because I kind of believe that to have good outcomes, you have to have really extreme responsibility. And, you know, how to balance that, I have no idea with modern life. I have no clue. But there is a balance somewhere. But yeah, I've thought about that. Will we all be in that kind of like more ACS kind of model across the board?
I agree with you. I mean, how do you learn responsibility, accountability to the patient, or just learn from your mistakes, which you might make, or just learn from whatever if you don't see your complication? You know, I thought that would be the end of the whole surgical world if, you know, in surgical training. But I do think that there are ways to adjust with that. But I know that is a real challenge, no doubt.
What about technology as it overwhelms our career and our profession? How do you view, and now even more with the uprise of artificial intelligence and large language models that I think is imminent. Trust me, I think it's imminent that we're going to get these co-pilots now on Epic. I mean, if we get, you know, right now we get these absurd things like you're going to give aspirin and Plavix together. You got to click 32 times to agree with this. But I believe that's going to go to the next level where you're saying, hey, you know, the leukocytosis is this and this and this and this and this and this and this. Is this patient maybe a lupus patient? And all of a sudden, all these things are going to start blowing up. How do you view technology being inserted into medicine now, contemporarily, and maybe, you know, in the next phase of your leadership career?
I think as physicians, we have to be involved so that it really helps us as docs and ultimately helps the outcomes of our patients, right? I mean, medicine has gotten so complicated that maybe it's not bad to have a reminder, right? I mean, we're still seeing people bleed on, you know, a patient going home on Coumadin, aspirin, and Lovenox or Eliquis or something like that. So I think we have to figure out how we can use that technology to provide better care for our patients and really to help us as docs, because it's, you know, as we said earlier, it's impossible to be perfect. So we have to figure out ways that we can be at the table where we can be a part of that, so it will help us and not make us do, you know, a million clicks.
I have my conspiracy theory about it. I think it's going to be tied to our malpractice. I think that it's going to get to a point where there's going to be so, and by the way, what we have now is just obviously very sucky. and those little automatic clicks that when X and C then give a alert that doesn't make much sense, a large language model will be actually able to understand that this patient just got an angioplasty and a stent. And so the combination of dual antiplatelet is probably what they need. And if actually, if anything, they'll probably tell you, hey, you need to make sure that you do it before they leave based on this data.
Yeah.
But then what's going to happen to the next level, to your point, is it is going to send all these alarms that are much more integrated. And hey, we looked at the images and we looked at this and like, so it'll make us better doctors, safer doctors. But it's almost going to be like, you need to do that, or you're going to have to pay triple your malpractice insurance. Because if you don't have, you know what I mean? Like if you're not AI accredited, certified, then you probably are a higher risk physician.
For you're going to have to be. You won't have a choice. I don't think you'll have a choice.
I think that's where it's going to go. Yeah. Where it's going to be financial, that we're going to have to almost like do it, you know, as an obligation.
That's going to be very interesting as far as like we were talking about culture. Like we probably have no idea how this is going to affect our lives. We can probably think about 1,000 things. But we probably like the way it affects like how we view ourselves, how we interact with patients, how a patient thinks of us. It's probably going to change dramatically. I don't know. Or maybe not. But I don't know. I feel like it's going to change a lot.
I think if you ask the patient, you know, oh, what do you think about artificial intelligence helping, you know, helping the physician give you better care? A patient's going to be like, yeah, I'm all in. You know, don't miss those nodules on the chest x-ray or all those incidental omas on the CAT scans. I really want to make sure that I get that followed up. So we have to figure out a way that it becomes more beneficial to everybody.
What would they think of the nurse practitioner that's doing your follow-up now is an AI-generated image on your cell phone, and it's not a real human? Because that could be a real thing. Yeah. For like your wound care. So will they be on board with that? What do they, you know, if that performs, it might perform better than us, right? So it can go a lot of ways.
If they perform better than the doc, if they're available off hours and on the weekends, and if they can do it 100%. On their computers, they're going to go for that and not me or you.
So do you think sometimes I think, and we're going completely off topic, and that happens on this podcast. You know, we're not talking about leadership anymore. But I think that when I'm 70 years old, there'll probably be no people training for it. I could see a world where there are no surgeons. I have a conspiracy theory. I think it's only going to be trauma surgeons.
You got to be like,
that could be that they're only trauma surgeons.
I think there's only going to be trauma surgeons and plastic surgeons. And plastic surgeons, because it's going to be fashionable to have a human. People are going to pay more because, mine was a human instead of like yours was a cheaper that was just a robot. But so I think the only two in 100 years, the only two surgeons that are going to be available are going to be trauma surgeons. You're probably there still in Philly and Temple.
Because the trauma surgeons are dinosaurs. That's why.
Yeah, but because I think that probably the last frontier where when a robot can treat like a, you know, multiple gunshot wound patients, like transmit a style gunshot wound. But, you know, at that point, we're done. Let's wrap it up.
Amy, do you see yourself doing this for a much longer time? Or do you feel this should be a short, brief period of your career and then you'll do something different?
As with my whole career, I don't ever see leaving Temple. And I am very aware that there is much less of my career ahead of me than was behind me. And I don't want to waste a single moment. So
it's very
interesting. Yeah, I'm going to be doing it for a few.
It's a very Amy Goldberg answer. All right.
Amy, I think that we're coming on about the hour, which is what we asked you to carve on a weekend. We're very appreciative of your time, of your thoughts, of your experience, of your leadership. I'm very happy that you sent this guy over. He was really cool to train. It was really cool to see blossom, and now to see him kind of be very thought provoking and become the person that he's become. It's been great, and I know it started, you know, with you and the group leader there. So very appreciative for your time and for what you did to this guy.
Yeah, thank you for carving the time and, you know, reminiscing a little bit about great things in the past. So we appreciate it. And hopefully people are I know people are going to be very inspired by the story like yours.
Well, thank you. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. Lucas, I hope it didn't scar you too much.
No, just a little bit. It's okay.
Like,
it's just a little bit of therapy.
My heart.
Yeah.
He's got a Harry Potter scar, but like in his heart.
From that, what? I don't know, Harry Potter.
Oh, God. Come on.
I better read that. All right. Well, thank you very much, Amy. Have a great
weekend. Thank you, guys. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. See ya.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.